Chapter 4. Whenever we take a new line of thought and drift into a new line of belief and action, the impulse is always suggested from the outside. Remorse so preyed upon the infidel that it dissolved his harshness toward the boy's religion and made him come to regard it with tolerance, next with kindness, for the boy's sake and the mother's. Finally, he found himself examining it. From that moment, his progress in his new trend was steady and rapid. He became a believing Christian. And now his remorse for having robbed the dying boy of his faith and his salvation was bitterer than ever. It gave him no rest, no peace. He must have rest and peace. It is the law of nature. There seemed but one way to get it. He must devote himself to saving imperiled souls. He became a missionary. He landed in a pagan country ill and helpless. A native widow took him into her humble home and nursed him back to convalescence. Then her young boy was taken hopelessly ill, and the grateful missionary helped her tend him. Here was his first opportunity to repair a part of the wrong done to the other boy by doing a precious service for this one, by undermining his foolish faith in his false gods. He was successful. But the dying boy in his last moments reproached him and said, "I believed, and was happy in it. You have taken my belief away, and my comfort. Now I have nothing left, and I die miserable, for the things which you have told me do not take the place of that which I have lost." And the mother, also, reproached the missionary, and said, "My child is forever lost, and my heart is broken. How could you do this cruel thing? We had done you no harm, but only kindness. We made our house your home, you were welcome to all we had, and this is our reward." The heart of the missionary was filled with remorse for what he had done, and he said, "It was wrong, I see it now, but I was only trying to do him good. In my view he was in error, it seemed my duty to teach him the truth." Then the mother said, "I had taught him, all his little life, what I believed to be the truth, and in his believing faith both of us were happy. Now he is dead and lost, and I am miserable. Our faith came down to us through centuries of believing ancestors. What right had you, or anyone, to disturb it? Where was your honor, where was your shame?" The missionary's anguish of remorse and sense of treachery were as bitter and persecuting and unappeasable now as they had been in the former case. The story is finished. What is your comment? Why? The man's conscience is a fool. It was morbid. It didn't know right from wrong. I am not sorry to hear you say that. If you grant that one man's conscience doesn't know right from wrong, it is an admission that there are others like it. This single admission pulls down the whole doctrine of infallibility of judgment in consciences. Meantime, there is one thing which I ask you to notice. Why? What is that? That in both cases the man's act gave him no spiritual discomfort, and that he was quite satisfied with it, and got pleasure out of it. But afterward, when it resulted in pain to him, he was sorry. Sorry it had inflicted pain upon the others, but for no reason under the sun, except that their pain gave him pain. Our consciences take no notice of pain inflicted upon others until it reaches a point where it gives pain to us. In all cases without exception, we are absolutely indifferent to another person's pain until his sufferings make us uncomfortable. Many an infidel would not have been troubled by that Christian mother's distress. Don't you believe that? Why? Yes. You might almost say it of the average infidel, I think. And many a missionary, sternly fortified by his sense of duty, would not have been troubled by the pagan mother's distress. Jesuit missionaries in Canada in the early French times, for instance. See episodes quoted by Parkman. Why? Well, let us adjourn. Where have we arrived? At this. That we, mankind, have ticketed ourselves with a number of qualities to which we have given misleading names. Love, hate, charity, compassion, avarice, benevolence, and so on. I mean we attach misleading meanings to the names. They are all forms of self-contentment, self-gratification, but the names so disguise them that they distract our attention from the fact. Also, we have smuggled a word into the dictionary which ought not to be there at all, self-sacrifice. It describes a thing which does not exist. But worst of all, we ignore and never mention the soul impulse which dictates and compels a man's every act. The imperious necessity of securing his own approval, in every emergency, and at all costs. To it we owe all that we are. It is our breath, our heart, our blood. It is our only spur, our whip, our goad, our only impelling power. We have no other. Without it we should be mere inert images, corpses. No one would do anything, there would be no progress, the world would stand still. We ought to stand reverently uncovered, when the name of that stupendous power is uttered. Why? I am not convinced. You will be when you think. Three instances in point, old man. Have you given thought to the gospel of self-approval since we talked? Young man. I have. It was I that moved you to it. That is to say, an outside influence moved you to it, not one that originated in your head. Will you try to keep that in mind, and not forget it? Why? Yes. Why? Because by and by in one of our talks, I wish to further impress upon you that neither you, nor I, nor any man ever originates a thought in his own head. The utterer of a thought always utters a second-hand one. Why? Wait. Reserve your remark till we get to that part of our discussion tomorrow or next day, say. Now then, have you been considering the proposition that no act is ever born of any but a self-contenting impulse, primarily, you have sought? What have you found? Why? I have not been very fortunate. I have examined many fine and apparently self-sacrificing deeds in romances and biographies, but, under searching analysis the ostensible self-sacrifice disappeared? It naturally would. Why? But here in this novel is one which seems to promise. In the Adirondack Woods is a wage-earner and lay preacher in the lumber camps who is of noble character and deeply religious. An earnest and practical laborer in the New York slums comes up there on vacation. He is leader of a section of the university settlement. Holm, the lumberman, is fired with a desire to throw away his excellent worldly prospects and go down and save souls on the east side. He counts it happiness to make this sacrifice for the glory of God and for the cause of Christ. He resigns his place, makes the sacrifice cheerfully, and goes to the east side, and preaches Christ and Him crucified every day and every night to little groups of half-civilized foreign paupers who scoff at him. But he rejoices in the scoffings, since he is suffering them in the great cause of Christ. You have so filled my mind with suspicions that I was constantly expecting to find a hidden questionable impulse back of all this, but I am thankful to say I have failed. This man saw his duty, and for duty's sake he sacrificed self and assumed the burden it imposed. Is that as far as you have read? Why? Yes. Let us read further, presently. Meantime, in sacrificing himself not for the glory of God, primarily, as he imagined, but first to content that exacting and inflexible master within him, did he sacrifice anybody else? Why? How do you mean? He relinquished a lucrative post and got mere food and lodging in place of it. Had he dependents? Why? Well, yes. In what way, and to what extent, did his self-sacrifice affect him? Why? He was the support of a superannuated father. He had a young sister with a remarkable voice. He was giving her a musical education, so that her longing to be self-supporting might be gratified. He was furnishing the money to put a young brother through a polytechnic school and satisfy his desire to become a civil engineer. O.M.M. The old father's comforts were now curtailed? Why? M.M. Quite seriously. Yes. O.M.M. The sister's music lessons had to stop? Why? M.M. Yes. O.M.M. The young brother's education, well, an extinguishing blight fell upon that happy dream, and he had to go to sawing wood to support the old father, or something like that. Why? M.M. It is about what happened. Yes. O.M.M. What a handsome job of self-sacrificing he did do. It seems to me that he sacrificed everybody except himself. Haven't I told you that no man ever sacrifices himself, that there is no instance of it upon record anywhere, and that when a man's interior monarch requires a thing of its slave for either its momentary or its permanent contentment, that thing must and will be furnished, and that command obeyed, no matter who may stand in the way and suffer disaster by it. That man ruined his family to please and content his interior monarch, why? M.M. And help Christ's cause. O.M.M. Yes, secondly. Not firstly. He thought it was firstly. Why? M.M. Very well, have it so, if he will. But it could be that he argued that, if he saved 100 souls in New York, O.M.M. The sacrifice of the family would be justified by that great profit upon the what shall we call it? Why? M.M. Investment? O.M.M. Hardly. How would speculation do? How would gamble do? Not a solitary soul capture was sure. He played for a possible 3,300% profit. It was gambling with his family for hits. However, let us see how the game came out. Maybe we can get on the track of the secret original impulse, the real impulse, that moved him to so nobly self-sacrifice his family in the Savior's cause under the superstition that he was sacrificing himself. I will read a chapter or so. Here we have it. It was bound to expose itself sooner or later. He preached to the East Side rabble a season, then went back to his old dull, obscure life in the lumber camp, sir to the heart, his pride humbled. Why? Were not his efforts acceptable to the Savior, for whom alone they were made? Dear me, that detail is lost sight of, is not even referred to, the fact that it started out as a motive is entirely forgotten. Then what is the trouble? The author is quite innocently and unconsciously gives the whole business away. The trouble was this. This man merely preached to the poor. That is not the university settlement's way. It deals in larger and better things than that, and it did not enthuse over that crude Salvation Army eloquence. It was courteous to home but cool. It did not pet him, did not take him to its bosom. Perished were all his dreams of distinction, the praise and grateful approval of whom? The Savior? No, the Savior is not mentioned. Of whom, then? Of his fellow workers. Why did he want that? Because the master inside of him wanted it, and would not be content without it. That emphasized sentence quoted above reveals the secret we have been seeking, the original impulse, the real impulse, which moved the obscure and unappreciated Adirondack lumberman to sacrifice his family and go on that crusade to the East Side, which said original impulse was this, to wit. Without knowing it, he went there to show a neglected world the large talent that was in him and rise to distinction. As I have warned you before, no act springs from any, but the one law, the one motive. But I pray you, do not accept this law upon my say-so, but diligently examine for yourself. Whenever you read of a self-sacrificing act, or hear of one, or of a duty, done for duty's sake, take it to pieces and look for the real motive. It is always there. Why? M.M. I do it every day. I cannot help it, now that I have gotten started upon the degrading and exasperating quest. For it is hatefully interesting. In fact, fascinating is the word. As soon as I come across a golden deed in a book, I have to stop and take it apart and examine it. I cannot help myself.
Oh. Have you ever found one that defeated the rule?
Why? No, at least, not yet. But take the case of servant-tipping in Europe. You pay the hotel for service, you owe the servants nothing, yet you pay them besides. Doesn't that defeat it?
Oh.
In what way?
Why?
You are not obliged to do it, therefore it sources compassion for their ill-paid condition, and, oh. Has that custom ever vexed you, annoyed you, irritated you?
Why?
Well, yes.
Oh.
Still you succumb to it?
Why?
Of course.
Oh.
Why of course?
Why?
Well, custom is law, in a way, and laws must be submitted to everybody, recognizes it as a duty.
Oh.
Then you pay for the irritating tax for duty's sake? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.